To kick off our session, our first speaker today will be Dr. Alan Shapiro. He is a senior research hydrologist for the U.S. Geological Survey. He's a member of the Water Cycle Branch in the Earth System Processes Division of the Water Mission Area. Dr. Shapiro conducts research on groundwater flow and chemical transport in complex geologic environments, including fractured rock and karst aquifers. Dr. Shapiro's research has focused on the development of field techniques and equipment, modeling groundwater flow and chemical transport, and methods of integrating and interpreting geologic, geophysical, hydraulic, and geochemical information in characterizing fractured rock aquifers. Dr. Shapiro is also actively pursuing research in the characterization and remediation of various contaminants in fractured rock, including chlorinated solvents and other dense non-aqueous phase liquids. He is a graduate of Princeton University with a PhD in civil and geological engineering. He's been an adjunct professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University. Dr. Shapiro is a fellow of the Geological Society of America, and in 2004, he was the National Groundwater Association, NGWA, selected him as a Distinguished Darcy Lecturer. And Dr. Shapiro has also served on National Research Council panels that have produced extensive reports on key engineering and scientific issues facing the nation. Okay, Alan, I am going to hand things over to you.
Thank you very much, Cindy. I will start now, if that's okay. This presentation was originally prepared for an FRTR meeting held in May 2019. Today's presentation is an abbreviated version of that earlier presentation to fit within time constraints of today's webinar. I removed a variety of examples of developing conceptual site models associated with groundwater remediation. If there is an interest on anybody's part in discussing those concepts presented beyond the examples I give here in today's webinar, I encourage you to get in touch with me. My contact information is available on this slide and other resources. As the title of this webinar implies, the topic of this presentation focuses on identifying critical processes and scales and formulating conceptual site models. The intention is that identifying critical processes allows one to be efficient in site characterization, monitoring, and modeling to facilitate decisions at sites of groundwater contamination. However, before one can begin discussing conceptual site models, one needs to address what motivates the development of conceptual site models. CSMs, or conceptual site models, cannot be viewed as academic exercises in mapping hydrogeologic understanding. The development of CSMs and the understanding built into CSMs are dictated by site objectives. The 2005 National Research Council publication presents a really excellent discussion of objectives that govern activities at sites of groundwater contamination. In that document, the NRC panel identified what are referred to as absolute and functional objectives, where absolute objectives are defined as those higher order community and stakeholder requirements. For example, mitigating adverse human and ecological health effects is an absolute objective. Also, minimizing disturbances to the community can also be considered an absolute objective. In conducting site activities, these objectives are non-negotiable and transcend all other objectives in site activities. Absolute objectives are usually defined in negotiations among multiple stakeholders at the on-site of activities at a given site. Additionally, the NRC report defines functional objectives. These are the operational goals that are designed to successfully accomplish the absolute objectives. For example, source zone removal and implementing mitigation procedures to prevent off-site contaminant migration are possible functional objectives that can be formulated to achieve the absolute objectives. It should be noted that it is possible to accomplish absolute objectives using different combinations of functional objectives. In defining a conceptual site model, however, functional objectives are the driving force for formulating the conceptual site model and the associated site characterization, monitoring, and modeling that are needed as part of that CSM development. This is discussed here in a diagram from that 2005 NRC publication that describes the workflow to identify technologies for source zone treatments. What is critical in this diagram is identifying those junctures where data are required to develop and update the CSM. Those critical points make reference to satisfying the functional objectives. In this diagram, the focus is on identifying source zone treatments. However, as I noted earlier, achieving absolute objectives, for example, preventing adverse health impacts, could be accomplished with different combinations of functional objectives. For example, absolute objectives could be accomplished through institutional controls. You know, institutional controls would prevent future access to groundwater. The data requirements in developing a CSM for institutional controls will be significantly different than the data requirements associated with designing source zone removal. Thus, there is not necessarily a fixed methodology for achieving attributes of a CSM. The degree of detail needed to address functional objectives dictates the informational requirements in developing the CSM. However, functional objectives and the associated data requirements are potentially cumbersome. They require conceptualizing and detailing physical, hydrologic, biogeochemical, human processes, and operational controls over multiple spatial and temporal scales. For example, designing a mitigation scheme to prevent off-site migration requires characterization at the source zone and all the physical and chemical process information associated with the dimensions of the source zone. Over time frames that may range from daily operations associated with remedial treatments to time frames of years or decades to evaluate contaminant persistence in the source zone. Additionally, characterizing the potential for off-site migration requires information relevant to regional, geologic, hydrologic, topographic controls. Additionally, one may also need to incorporate off-site operational controls for groundwater withdrawals, such as community wells and management of surface water resources, for example, releases from reservoirs or contingencies for flooding and other hydrologic events. These processes may extend over dimensions of hundreds of meters to kilometers and may extend over time frames of decades or longer. Accumulating and synthesizing all of this information is somewhat daunting in the development of the CSM. In formulating CSMs to address functional objectives, it helps to compartmentalize our thinking about processes important to defining the CSM. In particular, thinking about processes that affect various reservoirs of contaminant mass and the fluxes of contamination between those reservoirs. To a certain extent, this is articulated in the diagram shown here that was put forward in various ITRC documents, also Tom Sale, Chuck Newell, and a variety of other publications. This document was prepared, or this diagram was prepared primarily to look at organic contaminants. The diagram predicts various contaminant phases that can exist, for example, the NAPL phase, aqueous phase, sorb phase, and vapor phase, and the recognition that mass can reside in different types of void space, low permeability material and transmissive material, in both the source zone and the downgradient plume. This diagram gives us a way of thinking about those processes that affect the storage and release of contaminants in each of these reservoirs, and the monitoring that may be needed to characterize the mass in these reservoirs and the fluxes between reservoirs. However, even with compartmentalizing our approach to development of CSM, there continue to be multiple scales and multiple processes that occur over time frames that extend over several orders of magnitude. So thinking about this diagram and the data requirements to address the development of the CSM continue to be quite daunting. This brings us back to our elephant and the old joke. Okay, how do we eat an elephant? Well, the answer is one bite at a time. In looking at this diagram and formulating a conceptual model to address specific functional objectives, we need to not only compartmentalize our thinking, but also prioritize our thinking. We need to identify those contaminant reservoirs and fluxes that dominate process outcomes and are relevant to the functional objectives under consideration, as well as identifying those spatial and temporal scales that dominate the process outcomes. This may then allow us to constrain and efficiently focus our efforts in data collection, the subsequent monitoring, the frequency of monitoring, and ultimately the modeling of these processes. By way of example, let's consider developing a conceptual site model associated with functional objective of mitigating off-site contaminant migration, and consider this scenario in a fractured rock environment. Fractured rock aquifers are regarded as a significant challenge to groundwater remediation. These environments are physically and chemically complex in characterizing groundwater flow and chemical transport. Unlike near-surface unconsolidated porous media, the hydraulic properties of the formation can vary dramatically from one location to the next, depending on the location and type of discontinuities in the rock. There are a number of references that provide extensive overviews of the complexity of fractured rock aquifers. The three reports shown here were published over the past several decades by the National Research Council and National Academies of Science and provide an excellent starting point from which to gain understanding of site characterization, monitoring, modeling groundwater flow and chemical transport in fractured rock with application to both waste isolation and groundwater remediation. Among the complexities that are encountered in fractured rock is the characterization of the hierarchy of void space, shown here. Fractured rock aquifers are characterized not only by discontinuities in the rock that may extend over meters to tens of meters due to local stress distribution, but also by void space associated with the intrinsic formation of the rock, which is referred to as the rock matrix. The rock matrix does not necessarily contribute to bulk hydraulic properties of the formation, but it can act as a reservoir for storage and release of contaminants due to chemical diffusion. This is illustrated here on the left-hand side, where we see bands of iron hydroxide staining on the rock adjacent to fractures. This is the location where oxygen has diffused from fractures into the rock matrix, resulting in this iron precipitate. Fractured rock aquifers are also characterized by larger scale discontinuities caused by regional stress characteristics. That's shown on the right of this diagram. This may give rise to aerially extensive zones that may either act as conduits or barriers to groundwater flow. In characterizing potential off-site contaminant migration, we recognize that fractures are the most likely mechanism for the advection of chemical mass off-site. The rock matrix also plays a role in that there may be a storage and release of mass in the rock matrix along groundwater flow paths. But to understand the movement of contaminant from one location to the next, it is the fractures that control this process. However, we recognize that there are numerous fractures that constitute groundwater flow regime. And these fractures exist over dimensions from centimeters to kilometers and perhaps larger. And thus we have to ask in developing a CSM, is it necessary to characterize all of these fractures? So let's step back and review what's known about fractures and their capacity to transmit groundwater. On the left-hand side of this diagram are results of testing in a bedrock borehole in crystalline rock. This is a testing site that was in central New Hampshire. The acoustic televiewer log provides an image of the borehole wall and indicates fracture locations. The televiewer log provides an opened and oriented view of the borehole wall. It's like opening up a wrapper on a soup can. Planar features that intersect the borehole will appear as a sinusoidal shape as that opened and oriented view, that wrapper on the soup can, is unfurled. We can see a large number of flat-lying fractures intersecting this borehole, but also there are fractures that have a distinctive dip. The strike and dip of fractures can be identified by the characteristics of the sinusoid on the borehole image. Also shown on this diagram are results of hydraulic tests conducted in this borehole. The tests were conducted with a straddle packer apparatus shown on the right-hand side to isolate discrete intervals of the borehole and either inject or withdraw water from discrete intervals to estimate the transmissivity. The transmissivity is a measure of the ease at which water can move through a given geologic material, and thus the transmissivity is the ease at which water can move through those individual or closely spaced fractures in that isolated interval. We see the transmissivity in these tests varies over approximately five orders of magnitude, from the detection limit of approximately 10 to the minus 10th square meters per second to approximately 10 to the minus 5th square meters per second. Also, it should be noted that transmissivity is not a smoothly varying function with depth. We see fractures that are at the maximum of the transmissivity immediately adjacent to fractures that are at the detection limit of the downhole equipment used in conducting these tests. Additionally, in looking at the configuration of transmissivity versus depth, we see perhaps two zones of high transmissivity. These zones of high transmissivity are orders of magnitude larger than the fractured intervals, other fractured intervals in the borehole, meaning that they have the capacity of transmitting hundreds the thousands of times more water than the other fractures under the same hydraulic gradient. It should also be noted that fracture transmissivity is not necessarily related to fracture density. We see multiple sections of the borehole with high fracture density, but these areas of high fracture density do not always correlate to elevated measurements of transmissivity. In fact, sections of that borehole with relatively sparse number of fractures have the highest transmissivity. Continuing our look at measured hydraulic properties of fractures, if we look at results of those single-hole hydraulic tests conducted in individual boreholes and compile them over a regional area of several kilometers shown here, we arrive at a frequency histogram shown in the lower right of this diagram. The frequency histogram shows a number of tests with results in various bins for the hydraulic conductivity. Here, the hydraulic conductivity is taking that transmissivity from those test intervals and dividing it by the length of that test interval. The range of measurements varies over approximately six orders of magnitude of all the tests that were conducted in more than 40 boreholes. I should also note that there are a large number of test intervals containing fractures where the transmissivity of the test interval was below the detection limit of the in-situ equipment. Those tests below the detection limit are not shown in this histogram, but they would be to the left of the dashed line on the histogram. In looking at this frequency histogram, we see that there are relatively few test intervals at the highest order, these highest transmissivity. These few fractures control the majority of groundwater flow. They account for hundreds to thousands to millions of times more water than those fractures in the remainder of the distribution. Thus, understanding contaminant advection does not necessarily require us to interrogate all fractures, but instead to characterize those transmissive fractures and their transmissivity. And their connectivity in space. Excuse me. So, in looking at mitigating off, designing a mitigation scheme for off-site contaminant migration, we have narrowed the focus of characterization for our CSM to only those most transmissive fractures and their connectivity. This information then allows us to design strategies that mitigate off-site contaminant migration. Talk a little bit more about methods of identifying the connectivity of fractures. I will provide a very brief example. Over the past 25 years, there have been numerous advances in identifying locations of transmissive fractures and their connectivity, including geologic mapping of brittle and ductile structures, surface and borehole geophysical methods, the development of multi-level monitoring equipment to use single boreholes for multiple purposes of collecting chemical information as well as hydraulic information, the design and interpretation of hydraulic and tracer tests, and various methods of modeling groundwater flow, including advances in parameter estimation to identify the spatial distribution of formation properties. Identifying transmissive fractures and their connectivity is a multidisciplinary operation where data is synthesized from multiple sources. One of the approaches is through hydraulic testing, which I'll demonstrate here. This is a plan view of a number of wells in a crystalline rock aquifer, that same aquifer setting that I showed earlier in the talk. And for simplicity, I've shown a cross-section through wells 1, 4, 5, 9, and 6. And in this test, water is pumped from an isolated interval in well 6, and fluid pressure responses are measured at other isolated intervals in the adjacent borehole. The distances between the two farthest wells in this setting is approximately 100 meters, perhaps a little bit more. The hydraulic responses to the aquifer test are shown here, where drawdown in each well is shown as a function of time in the upper left. The drawdown is the difference in the hydraulic head relative to the hydraulic head at the start of the aquifer test. Thus, it increases as a function of time. 6B is the pump interval and shows the largest drawdown. However, drawdown in the other intervals do not follow expectations associated with homogeneous aquifers. In homogeneous aquifers, drawdown decreases as a function of distance. In fractured rock, however, we see multiple intervals with the same drawdown, even though they are different distances from the pumped well. For example, drawdown in 6C and 9B have essentially the same drawdown, even though they are different distances from the pumped well. Additionally, what is also characteristic of these drawdown records is that there is a clustering of drawdown records. In particular, specific intervals have the same drawdown. This is explained by the presence of highly conductive fractures that connect intervals in different wells. For example, pumping in 6B produces a drawdown in 9A that tracks along the drawdown in 6B. We hypothesize this to be a series of highly transmissive fractures that intersect both of these intervals. As we continue to pump, fluid pressure propagates through less transmissive fractures until that pressure front hits another of the series of highly transmissive fractures. And once that pressure front hits those highly transmissive fractures, all intervals that intersect those fractures have similar responses because of rapid pressure propagation along those transmissive fractures. This is seen, for example, for intervals 6C and 9B. And you continue this, as we continue with pumping, pressure propagates through less transmissive fractures until it hits the next series of high transmissive fractures. For example, intervals 1B, 4B, and 5 have the same hydraulic, have the same drawdown response. Thus, we have a conceptual understanding now of the most transmissive fractures and their connectivity in space. In this field setting, there is not necessarily a backbone of highly conductive fractures that are connected over distances greater than tens of meters. The highly conductive fractures tend to be isolated in the rock and connected only through lower transmissivity fractures. We also see the same phenomena at other locations at this setting. That's not shown here, but I have other tests that have similar results. However, more information is needed to characterize the potential for off-site migration that is not captured in identifying only the most transmissive fractures and their connectivity. In particular, characterization of chemical processes are needed. For example, the location of source zones, the strength of source zones, chemical reactions, various attenuation processes. So we're not done. One approach to characterize the fate and transport of various contaminants is to attempt to explicitly incorporate all of these processes into a groundwater flow model dictated by our understanding of the connectivity of highly transmissive fractures. The diagram on the right-hand side gives an example of the wealth of chemical and physical sorption, desorption, biological processes that may exist for, you know, know, for example, for organic contaminants. The various chemical processes, you know, depicted here, you know, it are highly complex, and it may not be conceivable to incorporate all these into a groundwater flow model to talk about fate and transport with the idea of understanding how one can design a mitigation scheme for off-site chemical migration. Attempting to explicitly model these processes is conceptually complex, computationally intensive, and there is a high degree of parameter uncertainty. Just to give you a sense of the complexity of modeling chemical processes in fractured rock, take a look at the iron hydroxide staining on a fractures on a road cut. That's shown here on the bottom. If we map fractures and map those fractures that have an iron hydroxide staining, which is an indication of dissolved oxygen migrating through the fracture network, we see a rather complex pattern of fractures that are impacted by preferential flow. We see individual fractures where only a part of the fracture is impacted by iron hydroxide staining, whereas other parts of the fracture are not. Even areas where there is high density of fractures do not necessarily correlate to iron hydroxide staining. Thus, attempting to explicitly conceptualize and modeling these phenomena are likely to be highly uncertain. Instead, an alternative approach could be used to conceptualize mass transport. What we can potentially do is look at representative groundwater flow lines, and along those representative groundwater flow lines, attempt to look at those processes and bound those processes from chemical responses. For example, there are algorithms such as BioChlor, RemChlor, Matrix Diffusion Toolkit that have been developed and constructed to place bounds on processes that affect contaminant concentrations at downgradient locations. We could potentially use these algorithms to bound chemical processes along representative flow lines as a way of constraining our information in looking at off-site migration of contaminants. Thus, in the development of the CSM, for the purpose of designing mitigation of off-site contaminant migration, we conceptualize that the most dominant process is chemical advection and the subsequent characterization of those highly transmissive fractures. Other processes also play a role, but we can conceptualize those as bounding the outcome for chemical advection. Field information will also be required for those bounding calculations, but we are not expecting to explicitly modeling these processes along groundwater flow paths. Instead, we recognize what is the most dominant process, that is the chemical advection. Instead, we will be hypothesizing the magnitude of these chemical processes and potential impacts on contaminant fate between starting and ending locations from the source zone to an off-site compliance boundary, for example. So, in summary, it is really beneficial to have an understanding of all processes and scales that affect contaminant fate and transport. To address specific functional objectives, however, all processes and scales do not need to translate into a decision support tool. Recognizing critical processes and fluxes is important in terms of focusing our data collection and being efficient and economic in our data collection efforts. With that, I think I'd like to end, and I'll leave it up to Cindy and Jean to entertain questions here.
Okay, thank you, Alan. Let's see. I did have someone ask about groundwater impacted with creosols. Are you doing any work in that area?
Personally, no. I've reviewed a variety of documents associated with creosote. Creosote is a different actor than TCE. The time frames associated with it, because of its density and viscosity, will be different from those of TCE distribution. You may have a very elongated times to reach a stable distribution of creosote following its emplacement or its release on land surface. Whereas with TCE, which has different viscosity and density, different characteristics, density and viscosity, you may reach a relatively stable distribution of TCE much quicker than you do see in creosote distributions.
Okay, great. Let's see. I want to remind folks that if you have questions for Alan, you can enter them into the Q&A pod at the lower right. We have just a minute if we have some more questions come in. Otherwise, we'll go on to our next speaker. Okay, Alan, is there any other?
Yeah, go ahead. I would like to note that at the end of this, I list a series of references for those who are interested in topics related to what I presented here. If there's questions on these references or the need for other information, please don't hesitate to contact me.
Great, thank you. Okay, so we do have one more question. How was the pumping test done to identify the fractures? And did you use Pactoff zones or some other method? Can you describe that a little?
Okay, that the cross-hole aquifer test that was conducted used packers to isolate those most permeable intervals in the boreholes over this area of 100 meters by 100 meters. We recognized that it was those most transmissive fractures that were going to be some combination or backbone or some connectivity of those which were going to affect groundwater flow. A priori, we did not know what that connection would be. We had some idea based on various other methods, borehole geophysical methods, but by isolating those highly transmissive zones in each borehole and monitoring fluid pressure response, we were able to see where this pressure propagated first, where it propagated next, et cetera.
Excellent, thank you. Okay, so I think at this point we are ready to move to our next speaker. Thank you, Alan, for your presentation. If folks have more questions for Alan that pop up in your head later in the presentation, you can go ahead and write those in. If we have time at the end, we'll come back and ask those questions of our other speakers. Thanks again, Alan. Okay, now next up we are going to have Sophia Lee. She is a project manager and hydrogeologist for the Naval Facilities Engineering Command's Expeditionary Warfare Center, also known as NAVFAC EXWIC. While only recently joining the NAVFAC family, Sophia previously spent 8 years working as a consultant in Denver and in Boulder, Colorado. Her experience in the design, construction, and calibration of both regional and site-specific mod flow models has helped her to develop the opinion that when it comes to modeling, the less is more philosophy is usually apt for assessing most groundwater problems. In addition to groundwater modeling, Ms. Lee has also been involved in well installation and aquifer testing of groundwater wells for both remote and urban environments. Ms. Lee received her undergraduate degrees in geology and classical and Near Eastern archaeology from Bryn Mawr College, and her master's in hydrological sciences and engineering from the Colorado School of Mines. She's currently a member of the environmental restoration team and supports groundwater remediation and supply projects for the Navy throughout the world. Sophia, if you are ready, I will hand it over to you.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Let me just get my notes here. First, I'd like to thank the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable for the opportunity to speak with you all today. It's wonderful that we have an opportunity to talk about modeling and specifically how it can be used as a decision tool for evaluating remediation strategies. I just want to point out the previous talks from the FRTR meeting on this topic in May covered a wide range of topics, from the use of models at specific locations to their applicability at the program level. And if you aren't already signed up, I'd encourage you to sign up for part two of this discussion as well. While a number of the previous presenters at the FRTR meeting highlighted the benefits of groundwater modeling tools, including state and transport codes and risk-based decision schemes, as well as the development of forecasting tools. One topic that is of ongoing interest is how these particular models are selected and maintained. This question about selection and maintenance is both simpler and more complicated than it may seem. Simply put, a groundwater model needs to be as simple or as complicated as the question posed to it. Like the three bears in the classic fairy tale, you don't want a model that's overly simplistic nor overly complex. Instead, you want a model that's just right for the questions you're trying to answer. And this means that a model can and most likely will change through time, especially as the questions posed change, resulting in potentially multiple versions of the same system and varying levels of complexity between models. So for my talk today, I aim to cover three main goals. First, I want to define what I mean by simple and complex modeling. Second, I'd like to describe how the Navy has utilized these concepts to optimize pre-existing groundwater models for site cleanup. And three, outline some potential considerations when selecting the complexity intended. First, I also want to clarify that for the purposes of my discussion today, I'm going to be talking about groundwater models specifically related to groundwater flow and transport and utilizing the groundwater modeling code ModFlow. That said, the principles involved with complicating or simplifying models can and do apply to other types of models as well, so don't think that this is exclusive. So without further ado, let's talk about it. So what do I mean when I talk about complex and simple models? Let's start there. So by a simple model, I'm describing the following. I'm talking about a limited domain size, maybe fewer boundary conditions, larger grid size, limited calibration parameters, and maybe along with that coarser calibration statistics, and potentially less accurate source data, and in general, more of a general model rather than site specific. And I have an example here where you can see squares that are very simplistically designed. Let me get the little pointer up here. So as you can see, we have only four layers here as opposed to something more complex. This model is not to be confused with a complex model, and by complex I mean that there's a more varied domain, potentially region-wide, detailed boundary conditions frequently derived from complex data sets. Typically, this includes some more extensive calibration and potentially tighter calibration statistics, and you have the potential to be more accurate or to have more detailed data sources. And typically, we like to think of these complex models as being, quote unquote, more real world to site conditions. So both simple and complex models have their pros and cons. I've highlighted a few of these on the slide in front of you, but to summarize, simple models are just that. They're usually simpler, cheaper, and support a lower quality of data, though not necessarily. You can have really great data and still utilize simple models. More complex models are just that. They're more complex. They typically can have tighter fits to available data or have more parameters and inputs, and with more typically comes more cost as well. These models are typically more expensive, either computationally or fiscally. With each of these, you have pros and cons as well. However, there comes an equal balance, hopefully, between the two when you're choosing, depending on the situation. Two things, though, to bear in mind when thinking about the pros and cons between simple and more complex models is that every piece of additional design increases the complexity of the system, and each level of complexity increases the chance for model errors due to unforeseen interactions. So if it's so dangerous to miscalculate how simple or complex your model could be, then how does it happen? While there are a ton of explanations or excuses that could be used, typically in practice models end up too complicated or simple as they evolve. To illustrate this, I wanted to present an example. And as a clarifying note, it's really easy to say that these issues are caused by inexperience, and you see that a lot when modelers are talking about each other. But frankly, everyone is susceptible to too much complexity, and that's why I wanted to give the following example as to how. So let's take a typical site. Here we've got a site with a plume maybe in it. Here's the boundary. Let's see, can I get the mouse? There we go. Here's the boundary of a site boundary, and then you have a river over here and maybe some urban and industrial operations. So the first thing you do, everybody does this, is you make a site conceptual model. So over here I have my CSM, and it looks like there's some varying geologies as well as a plume at depths of varying concentrations. So we take our CSM, and then we put it into a bunch of squares into a model. And so here we have four layers to represent these four different types, and I gave a K, or hydraulic conductivity, to each layer. Now, after I have my Ks, obviously there's more going on to the system. So let's say I wanted to add a variable land use or recharge to incorporate the urban and the river on the edge. And then I also wanted to add some source infiltration at 0.1 feet per day. But that's not all that's going on. You know, I might have some flow through. I might have some leakage from the river. And before you know it, your model is a lot more complex than when you were initially setting out to build it. Additional considerations that would potentially need to be included in a model could include regional pumping, phytoremediation withdrawals, barrier injections, and other remediation strategies tried historically that add just additional levels of complexity and requirements on your data. And with this complexity, isn't just added as you construct the CSM, but at every single step in the process. And Mary Hill in 2006 highlighted some ideas about how to limit unnecessary complexities, which I highly recommend that everyone take a look at, as these suggestions can be very helpful. Some of them are listed in this table one on the right. So once you've built your model, you then have to calibrate it. And when it comes to calibration, there are many different pitfalls that can trip you up, encouraging the incorporation of more complexities as you try to explain or fit your model to the best results. I've outlined some here, but the key ones I wanted to point out include trying to calibrate or implement too many parameters, the over-tightening of parameter values leading to overconfidence in parameter estimations, and especially overfitting data. And as you can see on the figure here, in figure 2B, this is an example of overfitting where a more linear fit may be more appropriate based on the quality of your data. So some things to remember when it comes to added complexities and calibration are, one should always evaluate the sensitivities of parameters to get a feel for the likelihood that they can be estimated. That an overfitted model can be equal or worse than an underfitted model. What is the complexity necessary for the questions you're trying to answer? And frankly, what's accomplishable with the data limitations you have? So speaking of data limitations, I just wanted to briefly touch on this one as well. It's so easy to want to answer questions beyond the scope of data available, especially historical questions, and this comes up a lot when doing groundwater modeling. Therefore, it's totally okay to preface that a model's complexity or simplicity can hinge on the level of error already in the data available, as long as that's appropriate for the questions posed. To highlight this, I wanted to present the following example. So let's say you're collecting well measurements, and they've been collected with a sounder by someone sent out in the field with an accuracy of plus or minus 0.2 feet. So what this means is that, quote unquote, a perfect fit for an observed measurement of 10 feet at any given well location could be between 9.8 and 10.2 feet within the simulation. Therefore, any prediction within the model must be within the bounds of this error to be considered a perfect fit. But that means that if you're not getting 10 feet, well, that 10 feet might not actually be the accurate measurement value for your model. So this can come into play, especially when you get to more complex models, to make you want to overfit your data beyond the level of accuracy that's possible. So bearing all this in mind, let's look at two examples to see how the Navy has approached the complexity and simplification of groundwater flow models. So, welcome to Washington. Today we're going to be talking about two facilities in Washington State, specifically in the Puget Sound region. These locations were chosen because they have regional or site-specific models. Both have been optimized, so the groundwater models have been modified to answer different questions, and both models addressed today resulted in more applicable answers to restoration questions. And specifically, I'm talking about the locations with gold stars here. So first, let's go to Naval Base Kitsap. This is a situation where a legacy model was used and then simplified to better answer flow and transport questions. So where at Kitsap are we? Specifically, we're looking at OU2 at Site F. This is about a 0.75-acre site surrounded by a large forest. In a closed basin with no natural drainage, though Hood Canal is located about 1.5 miles west of the site. The hydrologically speaking, the impacted aquifer is a shallow zone separated from regional conditions by a confining unit, and the area of interest is approximately 80 to 100 feet thick in total of till and topsoil. This site was originally a lagoon that was used for disposal for approximately 12 years. Initial investigations were completed in the 1980s and 1990s, and further groundwater modeling was completed in 2015 to address new contamination discovered at the site. This 2015 modeling is what I'm referring to as the legacy model that was utilized. So looking at the legacy model itself, it included different geologic formations. However, they were within the same order of magnitude in terms of their hydraulic conductivities. And also the approximate area of interest remained the same between the legacy and modern model. For your reference, here's a figure including the approximate model domain with the applicable surface geology on your screen. So let's look a little bit more at the legacy model. We have four different hydrologic flow zones highlighted with different colors here. And these were meant to simulate the changes in geologic formations as seen on the figure on the right. When we look at the calibration statistics, we can see that there were a total of a few thousand observations, and that the fit in general was pretty good. We see an RMSE value of less than 10%, the scaled absolute residual mean is below 10%, and the scaled residual standard deviation is below 5% as well. Now, using these percentages, it's just meant to be guidelines, but it's good to see that the model fit relatively well for the area. So if the model fit well, then why did we want to change it? Well, frankly, the legacy model did not mimic this bend that was being observed in the contamination data. As you can see in this figure on the right, the plume was thought to start over here in the lower right and then bend around as it exited towards the northwest, whereas the initial model was much more of a linear plume design, as seen on this figure on the left. So after review of the model, the general head boundaries, which are located to the south, were determined to be forcing the water in the system to flow directly across the site rather than curving, as I previously described. And therefore, modelers simplified the model by removing the general head boundaries and placing drains along the northern edge to better simulate flow conditions at the site. To achieve this simplification, it was determined that the boundary conditions were over-influencing the flow directions. within the model and effectively eliminating the bend in the flow direction. And to eliminate this problem, as I described, specific heads were removed from the model and drains were added to the north. So what did this result in? Well, let's compare them. When the model was simplified, the calibration statistics in general were less precise than the model data. That said, there are a few things to bear in mind. The number of targets between the two models increased, as we can see here, and that the fit of the flow directions of the observed plume movements were considered to be more applicable in the simplified model than the legacy model. So even though the statistics might not be as good, the overall behavior of the plumes was better. So again, as a result, you can see here. In summary, the simplification of the model allowed for the addressing of questions posed related to specific flow dynamics that were otherwise unanswerable. So for some quick conclusions, this conclusion emphasized the following two points: that the original model fit typical modeling statistics, however it may have been an overfit for transport purposes, and that simplifying the model boundary conditions allowed for more flexibility in flow direction, and ultimately for a better transport model. Can I get a quick time check, Cindy?
You are good on time. I think you've got about another 20 minutes.
Oh, perfect. Okay, great. And we definitely have time for the second part. So let's switch over to across the peninsula here to Naval Air Station Keyport. In this instance, adding complexity to the system was vital to addressing the questions posed within the remediation site. And just a word of note, this model is still undergoing a review process. However, the results of this investigation are already applicable to addressing the issues raised at the beginning of this talk. So the location at Keyport is location OU1. It's approximately a 9-acre former landfill site surrounded by a large forested area and potentially outflowing the surface water and to the south and to the east. Groundwater flow directions in this area ultimately flow to Dogfish Bay through tidal flats. This site, like the last one, was also a disposal location. In this case, however, it was also an unlined landfill and much, much larger than that which was seen at Kitsap. The site received paint waste, residues, solvents, as well as fuel, wastewater treatment plant sludge, pesticides, rinsates, and other landfill material. And of particular note at this location, its proximity to tidal flats and surface water make it really important that we address this model from a more complex perspective. Looking at the regional geology, because of the proximity of the site to tide flats as well as deposition in former marsh environments, the area of interest is the shallowest 50 feet, which is comprised of clays, silts, and sands above a deeper confining unit at depth. And it's thought that this confining unit could be anywhere from 90 to 100 feet down. Looking at what models were available, at this location, no specific modeling had been constructed previously. Instead, a regional flow model of the entire peninsula was used to assess the flow directions through the southern portion of the site. This original model comprised of approximately 575 square miles with 14 model layers and a pretty solid statistics from the calibration. That said, these calibration statistics are for the whole region and not just the area we're interested in, which had a few concerns with it. And there's the calibration statistics for the whole model. Looking at the concerns of the regional model, these concerns included the following. While the model fit pretty well regionally, it didn't mimic known groundwater divide seen at the site, and the model cell size was too large for transport modeling to answer the questions posed at this location. shallow zones were not adequately modeled as well to address the complexities of the clays and sands in the subsurface, as well as flows to local streams, and therefore a more complex and focused model site was determined to be necessary. So when we began the refinement objectives, to address these concerns, the following objectives were proposed: that we needed to have a model refinement of the area of interest, added vertical refinement in the area of interest, a recalibration of the area with more site-specific water levels and flows, and to convert the system to a more complex density-driven environment to account for the potential salinities associated with Dogfish Bay. Just as a note on the vertical refinement of what I'm referring to get clarity on the upper zones, the top layer of the regional model was split into six distinctive layers, which you can see here based on the geologic modeling completed by the folks over at the USGS, which was then translated into a flow model for the more site-specific example. In terms of the refined model domain, a lot could be said about this latest interpretation of the site region, but if not here, it's that the regional flows were incorporated at the edges with special emphasis being placed on including the surface water features missing from the more generalized regional interpretation. And you can see that in the figure here where there was an emphasis placed on the tidal flat being added into the model as well as seasonal creeks and ponds and streams, which were not necessarily present in the original domain. So once this more refined model was constructed, it was also calibrated. And by incorporating additional complexities to the model, the area of interest was able to get a tighter fit in the area of the site. While the model calibration has an RMSE at 15% rather than the desired generic of 10% or lower, the average error within the area of interest was 9 feet as opposed to 47 feet within the regional model. So we consider this, even though it's additional complexity, to be a success in terms of the calibration fit. Just as additional comparisons, let's look at the water levels. The new model can better simulate the influences of observed groundwater divides not exhibited in the regional model, and this is most likely due to the coarseness of the regional model versus the more refined areas within the smaller domain. So just some site conclusions and conclusions. Adding complexities as well as refining the model allowed for us to have a better tool with which to answer our site-specific concerns. Also, by implementing a more refined geology and boundary condition, this was especially important for the groundwater divide question and flow directions, to provide our RPM with transport tools or with tools to answer transport questions at the site. So when looking at the two case studies presented previously, a few takeaway points can be seen. Both locations optimized existing groundwater models to address new questions, one by simplifying the domain and one by adding complexity to address local shallow zone dynamics. In addition, while model adjustments provided less specific fits that were provided with the original models, the dynamics under consideration improved. In the case of Kitsap, simplifying the model increased the impact of pumping on particles to transport the contaminants of concern throughout the domain, mimicking more real-world observations with that bend. And in the case of Keyport, by increasing complexity and cell refinement, it allowed for better localized fits and field-observed groundwater divides. Ultimately, both models provided quote-unquote better results than the original models for the modified questions posed at both locations. So since both sites were modified differently, how do you choose what model modifications may be necessary for addressing a particular site? And so I wanted to provide the group with some potential questions and whether or not a simpler or more complex model design might be appropriate. It's important to recognize that every site is unique and that it's best to consult with an expert prior to model selection. That said, here's some general guidelines that could be applicable to addressing some of the questions posed. For example, what is the extent of the area of interest? If the extent is not very large, a small domain or simplified regional flows might be more appropriate. However, if you have a larger plume or a more complex geology, then larger regional considerations might be necessary, leading to a more complex system. In addition, what's really important is what deadline are you working under? Even though we don't like to think about fiscal and temporal constraints as being a concern, they're very applicable when it comes to groundwater modeling, in the sense that you might be able to get a 70% answer with a simpler design rather than waiting to get a more complex answer that could take months or years to determine the best result. Depending on what the specificity of your questions posed looks like, the availability of reliable and accurate data and the timeline or budget that you have should typically drive the complexity of your system. So just some final considerations to take into account. We always should remember that garbage in equals garbage out, which is why the accuracy of your data can be so vital in deciding the complexity of your model. In addition, complexity can both add to and detract from your accuracy of your results. And determining the level of complexity you need is key to adequately modeling your system. This level of complexity needed may change through time, requiring an optimization or modification of your interpretations and your models, leading to multiple models, potentially for the same site. And finally, sometimes a simple model may be the best option, even if the result is more conceptual than site-specific. Ultimately, this process has proven useful at a number of Navy sites and will continue to be considered in the future. It is vital to consider the level of complexity or simplicity needed when approving, accepting, and utilizing modeling at your remediation location. So with that, I'd like to thank you for listening and open it up to questions.
Thank you, Sophia. We've had a few questions coming in for you. So first off, someone was curious whether you all considered tidal effects in your models, or was that included?
Ooh, good question. So it wasn't included at the Kitsap site because it was considered part of a closed basin and far enough away to not be impacted by tidal influences. At the Keyport site, that is an ongoing question, and I believe they're still doing studies to determine what that impact would look like. So it might be included at a later date.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we have another participant ask, it looks like when evaluating model complexity, there are ways to quantify parameter uncertainty, but it looks like the evaluation of structural error is qualitative. Can you please comment on that?
Yes, this is one thing that was discussed a lot at the FRTR meeting that we had back in May. It is, at the moment, it is a qualitative game. Not game, that's the wrong term. But it's a qualitative decision up to the modelers. I'm not aware of any particular official standards when it comes to estimating model parameters. So that's another reason why it's really important to get an expert involved when making these decisions to see, well, is your model fit good enough to answer the questions being posed? And some things to bear in mind when assessing that are, again, I can't emphasize this enough, but the accuracy of your data, as well as the applicability or understanding of your system. And that can really, when we step back and we take a hard look at ourselves and our data, what is really achievable within the scope of your modeling project in order to determine whether your model is accurate enough. So I wish I could say, oh, well, we have set standards or set numbers that you can follow, but unfortunately it is still a quality or a, not a quantifiable assessment, but a qualitative assessment, even though we use statistics in order to give us numbers that can quantify what those values are.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. I had another participant asked, were you working on developing a steady state flow model?
So for the Kitsap site, it was a steady state, and I think they had a transient simulation as well. And for the Keyport, they had two. They had a steady state and a transient simulation.
Great, thank you. Okay, at this point, I want to thank you, Sophia. And if you'll stay on the line, we'll come back to you for questions at the end, if those come in. Now, I want to move on to our next speaker. Our next speaker is Dr. Haruko Wainwright. She's a research scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. She earned a master's in nuclear engineering and statistics and PhD in nuclear engineering at the University of California in Berkeley. Her research focuses on hydrological modeling, spatial statistics, data integration, and uncertainty quantification. She has worked on various research topics in both nuclear engineering and environmental sciences, including nuclear waste, groundwater contamination, Fukushima radiation monitoring, and climate change impacts on ecosystems. Dr. Wainwright, if you're ready, please go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me in this webinar. So in this talk, I will talk about the importance of monitoring and how we can use modeling, particularly high-performance computing-based reactive transport modeling, to optimize monitoring strategies. So I work in one of the DOE, Department of Energy, labs, Berkeley Lab. Department of Energy, DOE, manages more than 100 sites in U.S. that were used for nuclear weapon production. Over the last 30 years, DOE has made a significant progress in remediation. The majority of the sites have been closed or transitioned to the site closed process. There are 16 sites remaining currently. These 16 sites are challenging. These sites have complex contamination, including multiple radionuclides, heavy metal, and other organic compounds. Some of the plumes are very hard to access, like deep beta zone at Hanford site. Some sites have very big plume, large volume plume with low contamination. So it's not practical to remove all the contamination or soil, and the treatment removal technologies are getting not so effective because of low contamination. So I want to talk a little bit about sort of the recent transition in the remediation. So over the 30 years, that's the time frame of the DOE site remediation, soil and groundwater remediation has been evolving from basically doing nothing to very, to very intensive treatment, and now there are movements called sustainable or green remediation. So over the last 30 years, people have realized that removing contaminant or remediation has a significant side effect. Cost is, of course, one thing, but remediation produces a lot of waste. This is a particularly problematic for radionuclide. Becomes a radioactive waste. Also, remediation produces a lot of CO2, it uses a lot of energy, and it has ecological disturbances and environmental disturbances. So now there is an industry consortium called Sustainable Remediation focused on this topic. Sustainable remediation is often coupled with attractive end state or redevelopment plan with restrictive subsurface uses, for example, solar farms, parks, like nature reserves or factories. These kind of approaches are particularly attractive and important for the DOE sites, since many of the sites would have residual contaminants for an extended time. So sustainable remediation aims to reduce net environmental benefit. In addition to contaminant removal, it considers energy usage or ecological impact and waste. It tries to do a lot of recycling and reduce waste, for example. And also, they tend to focus on passive remediation and monitor natural attenuation that reduce a lot of waste and energy and water use. However, this requires increased burden of proof, such that we have to make sure that the plumes are stable and it does not have any significant health effect. So for this, environmental monitoring is very important to provide such proof. Particularly recently, there are several instances that monitoring is not just ensuring public safety, but it's good for operators to prepare for liability issues. So I have good example and bad example here. Here is a good example first. This article said activists ignore the science that say Rocky Flat is safe. Basically, at this site, a lot of monitoring data set, well-archived monitoring data has proved that the site is safe, and it was able to dismiss false claims. In the right-hand side, I have a bad example. So the current Tokyo fish market in Japan is constructed at the former gas plant that has groundwater contamination. So that's it's called Toyosu. So they found anomaly in groundwater data, and they couldn't explain it. So they had to spend extra $100 million. So monitoring is very important to prove that the site is safe and it can satisfy criteria. Otherwise, it might have a big consequence. So our research goal have been to support the transition from active to passive remediation and ultimately monitor natural attenuation. Monitoring can provide additional lines of evidence for such transition. For example, this has a big cost implication. At Savannah Riverside Estuary, for example, they transitioned from active to passive remediation, and that it saved a lot of basically taxpayers' dollars from $12 million per year to $1 million per year. We aim to improve long-term monitoring strategies because now long-term monitoring becomes a big part of the life cycle cost. And not just saving cost, we want to improve the safety of the site and bring in new technologies to detect new leaks or new migration, and also ensure long-term stability of the plumes. For example, there are a lot of discussions about the impact of climate change, flooding, or drought these days. Savannah River National Lab and Berkeley Lab have been collaborating to develop new paradigm of long-term monitoring by taking advantage of recent advances in in-situ sensors, wireless network telecommunications, and also cloud computing and also machine learning methods. So now there are very cheap or affordable sensors that can measure many groundwater quality parameters like water table, pH or redox, and electrical conductivity or specific conductance. We might call these parameters as master variables, since these parameters can control the plume mobility. So we can detect changes of the plume mobility by looking at these parameters real time, and also by looking at the correlations between these variables and contaminant concentration, we could be able to, we can estimate contaminant concentrations in situ real time. So we have established the data analytics framework for this paradigm. So it starts from exploratory data analysis, and we can identify correlations between contaminant concentrations and other variables. For example, I hope you can see it, but in this plot, I'll explain in the next slide, but we found a correlation between pH and rhenium. Of course, pH is driving the rhenium mobility. In the next step, we can actually quantify the correlations. For example, in this case, we found a very good correlation between rhenium concentration, and specific conductance in the groundwater. And in the third step, based on this quantified correlation, we can predict the contaminant concentration real time based on common filter. So yes, in terms of big data analytics, we found that PCA principal component analysis is very useful to find the correlation between master variables and contaminant concentration. Here, as I mentioned, pH and rhenium are opposite in arrows. This has a big negative correlations. We have sort of the group of nitrate, technetium, specific conductance. These represent non-reactive tracers. Common filter is the way to integrate the institute data set and the site knowledge so that we can do institute real-time estimation of contaminant concentration. So this is actually the demonstration by historical data sets. So we have the historical data sets from 96 to 2014. So this is the tritium concentration estimation and rhenium concentration estimation. So that this is the training period up to 2004. And then this red line is the predicted or estimated concentration. And blue dots are real measurements. So we can see that the predicted concentrations are well agreed with the measured concentration, and also we can sort of capture little bumps in the concentration data set. So we published this work last year. It got a lot of press attention. So we published in EST. I think people very interested in the use of new technologies like sensor technologies and machine learning methods in groundwater and environmental monitoring. So the question now is why we still do modeling and how we can use modeling to support these monitoring strategies. We think that modeling is important to confirm and also understand these correlations, particularly the correlation between master variables, in situ measurable variables versus contaminant concentrations. We also would like to investigate the impact of the climate change or climate disturbances and investigate, for example, how to place monitoring wells so that we can capture the responses to flooding or other events. The third bullet is we just started working on it, but this is our next step. We want to use modeling results to we want to use modeling results to optimize monitoring well placement. For example, modeling can produce simulated plume evolution, so we can place monitoring wells based on those. Our demonstration site is Sabana River site F area, So this site has former disposal basins, basically the ponds, where low-level radioactive acid waste solutions were disposed, even in the 80s. Currently, this site has a big acidic plume with multiple radionuclides, uranium, strontium, and iodine, and tritium. The pH is still very low, like up to as low as 3 or 3.5. This site has many remediation activities, including pump and treat. As I mentioned, they transition to passive remediation based on the pH neutralization and immobilization of uranium. The site is expected to transition to natural attenuation in the future. We are using a modeling code called AMANSI. This code was developed under DOE's ASCAM project, Advanced Simulation Capability for Environmental Management. So AMANSI is HPC-ready reactive transport code, and it has a unique interoperable structure such that, so AMANSI deals with flow and transport. It has advanced finite element method, and it can couple with any chemistry engines depending on the needs, so that it has sort of flexible framework that can represent any geochemical reactions. That interface is enabled by the Arrhenius interface. Our geochemical model includes many reaction networks, particularly to capture pH dependency of the mobility of uranium. It has aqueous and surface complexation and mineral dissolution precipitation and so on. We have a pretty good hydrogeological conceptual model here. There are two aquifers, permeable aquifers, upper and lower aquifers, separated by clay-rich region. It's called Tanclay or TCCZ. And this is the basin, so that plume starts from here, and then the plume eventually goes out in the seepage phase and then to the river. So we have developed 3D mesh, including the heterogeneity of this Tanclay clay-rich zone. And it also has the barrier structures for the passive remediation. So this is the plume evolution video. Cynthia, can you play? I start, hopefully. So yes, the plume goes down vertically first and spreads laterally in the groundwater. Now it reaches the river here. And you can see that a lot of contaminants, or in this case, uranium, is stuck in the beta zone and also the clay zone, because clay zone has low permeability. So we are interested in this residual contaminant in the beta zone and also in the clay rich zone. Can I go back to the slides, please? Thank you. So in terms of the simulation results, we have pretty good agreement with observations, not just uranium and not just uranium, but other analytes. And using this model, we can simulate the correlation between master variables and uranium concentration. So we have four figures here. So this is the simulated correlation between uranium and nitrate concentration. Basically, nitrate is the specific conductance or electrical conductivity at this site. So this arrow represents from the 1950s to current condition to the future. So there is a time evolution here. And these dots represent the time that is corresponding to measured time. So we can see that in the measured correlation between uranium and nitrate, we have very good correlations, and that's this region. But the nitrate correlation will change in the future. It's not linear. On the other hand, the correlation between uranium and pH, this starts from 1950s, and this is the current time and goes to the future. The correlation between uranium concentration and pH will be pretty linear into the future. So from these results, we can know what to expect in our monitoring strategies, and we can plan for this. So the next topic is the resilience to climate disturbances. We expect increasing frequency of extreme events like flooding and drought, and we want to know that what happened to the residual contaminants that we saw in the basalt zone and clay rich zone, and also we want to know what we can do better with monitoring. So we just published two papers on this topic. Actually, my student looked really hard for the papers or references, but she couldn't find so many. So I think these are actually the first sets of papers that address climate change impact on remediation or contamination. So in this paper, and particularly the second paper, Libera et al., we investigated the impact of flooding and drought on residual contaminants using modeling. So that flooding and drought impact can be considered by plus and increasing or decreasing precipitation or temperature. That can be translated to infiltration amount or ET. So basically, how much recharge goes into this aquifer. It sounds simple, but it's not, because more water, for example, has trade-offs. So more water could mean it could mobilize contaminants, but also more water can mean dilution. So there could be competing effects. So we need to investigate more quantitatively using modeling. So this is the timeline that we assumed. So the basin was operated. Basin was operating between 56 and 89. So now the basin is closed and capped, and we assume that something will happen in 2020, I guess next year. We assumed, in this case, large flooding, very extreme precipitation this year, 2 times to 10 times. So this is the concentration as a function of time at soilstone well and also downgrading well, and this is the export to the river. So this is a very extreme, yellow is a very extreme case, 10 times precipitation. So the soilstone well, we can see increase in concentration because that the basaltstone residual contaminants were mobilized. At the downgradient well, the concentration decreased first because there is a dilution, and then remobilized contaminant arrives and the concentration increases. We were surprised to see that the effect actually linger for basically 2 decades. If we don't know this effect, probably we could wonder what happened. Like, no one would expect that, like, event in 2020 would have an effect in, like, 2030. So that's kind of modeling results can sort of guide our understanding. Okay, this could something that this is something that we need to expect. The good thing is that these results show that the impact on export to the river, basically this is the risk pathway, it doesn't have huge effect because export is an integrated measure over time and space, including the discharge from the lower aquifer, which was not impacted by flooding significantly. And we also found that soil well probably is very important to monitor because we can detect the remobilization of residual contaminants in soil. So we are moving on to the last topic, monitoring optimization. So we just started this research, so I don't have significant results, but I want to show you some of our aspirations. So currently there are many technologies to map contaminant distribution surface and subsurface, like geophysics, for example, and some of the radionuclides can be mapped airborne. And of course, simulated plumes can be considered as like maps. So how maybe we can use this information to optimize well placement, and we can identify key monitoring locations. I want to show one example from the monitoring project in Fukushima. We have a big monitoring and data analytics project. We have developed an algorithm to integrate different multi-scale radiation measurements that have different types and footprint of data sets, and we can quantify uncertainty, and we can provide integrated map of radiation air dose rates. And this has been adapted by regulatory agency in Japan. And this map is now being used to guide decontamination and other activities. And also we are using this map to guide monitoring post-optimization. So it's been 10 years from the Fukushima accident, so there's a need to transition from more emergency response type monitoring to long-term monitoring. And we want to capture the heterogeneity of this contamination with fewer sensors. We have developed machine learning methods to effectively reduce the number of monitoring locations from these blues, like 255 locations to 100 locations. And we've confirmed that basically as number of monitoring posts increases, the error of capturing heterogeneity decrease, but there is sort of the enough number of monitoring locations, let's say like around 100, this we can say this is enough. So this way we can say 100 locations would be enough, and this can capture the spatial heterogeneity. In this case, we have radiation map over the entire region. In the groundwater case, of course, it's not the case. Subsurface, there's a lot of uncertainty, but we can use simulated plumes as the contaminant map to guide monitoring well optimization. Yes, we are now working on this approach, extending this approach to the monitoring well optimization at the F area for the groundwater plume. So I showed a couple of examples, but basically here is the summary. We are developing cost-effective strategies for long-term monitoring based on new in-situ sensors for continuous monitoring rather than just relying on groundwater sampling quarterly or yearly. We can reduce the cost while enhance the safety and detecting the anomaly much more quickly. And we have developed data analytics methods, common filter methods, for example, to estimate contaminant concentrations based on in-situ measurable variables. We think that modeling is very important to support such monitoring strategies. Modeling can confirm, for example, correlation between master variables or in-situ variables versus contaminant concentrations, and we can extrapolate that to the future to determine the efficacy of this monitoring strategies in the future. We can see or we can investigate the impact of climate change or climate disturbances like flooding, drought, what to expect, and also what to monitor, where to monitor. And then eventually we want to use this approach or modeling to more better optimizing monitoring locations. So I hope you got the sense of our research activities. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Wainwright. Well, it seems that I have just lost my internet connection, so we'll try to get that back online. Let me just ask you a question that's not necessarily modeling related, but I'm curious, how did SNRL or LBNL become involved with this Fukushima modeling? Because obviously this is an international event, so I'm curious how you all got pulled in on that, and what has that been like working with another country?
DOE has been actually contributing to Fukushima remediation efforts significantly. Basically, even during the accident, the Japanese government contacted U.S. government and asked for a lot of help. U.S. government has contributed to like remediation activities at the sites and also monitoring. For example, the first airborne radiation mapping that was done by the American equipment. So we have a lot of interactions and collaborations between DOE or national labs and Japanese government, and this is one of the activities.
Thank you. Yeah. So right now I need to see if Jean Ballant is on the phone and can jump in to help me out here. I lost my connection. Thanks, Jean.
And that is not a problem. I am here and connected, and I'm happy to step in. So just like Cindy said, I'll remind the audience that you do have a Q&A window in the lower right corner where you can share your questions and comments for our speaker. If you don't have any questions or comments, you can also enter that on in. That just helps us get a sense for where the audience is. Sometimes people are busy typing their messages away, and we just can't see the keystrokes. I did see a question that had come in, and I think that this might be directed towards you, Dr. Wainwright, but let me just ask. When you were looking at locations for monitoring, how did you include location into your decision making when you were determining the density at which you would then locate these monitoring spots?
Hi, for the Fukushima case particularly, mm-hmm. we considered sort of how we can do interpolation based on the sparse locations, and then we decided, we computed the estimation error or interpolation error, and we have decided that enough number of monitoring posts by looking at the convergence in the interpolation error.
Okay, great. All right, thank you. Again, I'll just ask one more time if there are other questions or comments for our speaker. You can feel free to enter those into the Q&A window. If you don't have any questions, you can also enter that in just so that we know that you guys are happy and we can move on with the seminar. If anybody happens to be on the phone line and you would like to ask a question on the telephone lines, you're welcome to come off of mute by pressing #6 since we do have a little bit of time. So you're certainly welcome to unmute by hitting #6, and you can feel free to ask your question directly on the phone. Okay. Well, I don't hear anybody coming off of mute, and I've gotten a number of thank you messages in here into the webinar environment, so I actually think we might be okay in terms of Q&A. Cindy, were there some closing statements or thoughts you'd like to share before we wrap up today's live event?
Jean, I'm good. I think we can, if you can control the slides over for closing out, then I can go ahead and read off these announcements.
All right. So just so you know, Cindy, I've gotten a couple of thank you messages from the audience, and I'm pulling up those closing slides right now. So feel free to begin.
Thank you. I just wanted to remind folks that if you enjoyed today's session, we do have a part two coming up. And thanks also to Sophia Lee for mentioning that. So next week on Wednesday, December 4th, we will have session two of FRTR Presents Modeling in Support of Site Remediation. On that webinar, we'll be joined by Dr. Noman Azanamazan of EPA, Scott Morgan of AECOM, and John Fenske of U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And we will continue with this topic with those three talks. So I'd like you to please feel free to connect with CLUIN using our social and professional network sites. You'll find CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and on LinkedIn. You can also sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, to learn about new webinars and resources related to hazardous waste site cleanup. Thanks again for joining today's live webinar. I'd like to remind participants that slides and other items related to this session can be found on the seminar resources page. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. You'll also find information for our speakers and organizers on the presenters page, as noted earlier. I'd like to ask you to take a brief moment to fill out the online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session, both of the content covered and the method of delivery. Although we don't offer PDHs or CEUs for our webinars, you can save or print a webinar participation certificate after you've submitted feedback for today's event. Be sure to check the box at the bottom of the feedback form to certify that you were here for the entire event or that you replayed the complete archive. If you don't check the box, it will not generate the certificate. You may find that a copy of your registration email, the seminar slides, and the feedback confirmation email are enough to document your participation in today's event with your own accrediting institution for PDHs or CEUs. If you participated as a group, each person can fill out the online feedback form to get their own certificate. This applies to those watching the recorded version as well. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms, so please go ahead and fill those out. We can also suggest or request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. If you require further assistance, please feel free to contact Jean.